Yale Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Macmillan Report. I'm Marilyn Wilkes, your host, and our guest is Edward Ruggemer, an associate professor of African American Studies and History at Yale. He studies comparative slavery and abolition and antebellum U.S. history. Today we'll talk with Professor Ruggemer about his new book, Slave Law and the Politics of Resistance in the Early Atlantic World, for which he was recently awarded the Macmillan Center's Gustav Ranis International Book Prize for Best Book. Welcome, Professor Ruggemer.
Thank you.
So let's start with your book. Tell us about it.
It's a comparative study of Jamaica and South Carolina for a fairly long period of time, starting in the 17th century when both of these colonies are established, mm-hmm. And extending into the 1830s. And I take that what's called the long durée approach, because I wanted to understand how the politics of slavery evolved over time, mm-hmm. and how that shaped the political history of both these slave societies, these slave colonies, in distinct ways.
Okay.
And so the first chapter is actually on Barbados, because Barbados is England's first slave society, and both Jamaica and South Carolina are established by men who had been very involved in the establishment of Barbados and had seen the lucrative, how profitable slavery was in, mm-hmm. Barbados.
Okay.
And they wanted to establish the same thing in Jamaica and South Carolina. But because of the different geographies and because North America and the Caribbean are very different places, mm-hmm. and the different possibilities for crops that were in both of these places, they evolved in distinct ways. Mm-hmm. And so most of the book is really focused on that power dialectic between slave resistance, which is a constant, but sometimes emerges in rebellions, and I'm particularly, mm-hmm. interested in slave rebellions. And then on the other side, the way that masters responded to these things, the way slaveholders responded to these things, principally through the law. And I was interested in how these English and British assemblies codified slavery, and the laws allow us to see not necessarily the social reality of these slave societies, mm-hmm. but the way that masters wanted these slave societies to be governed, the way they wanted things to, mm-hmm. to run. And I take that dynamic and I follow it straight up to the 1830s when slavery is abolished in Jamaica, in part because of a major slave rebellion that happens in 1831, known as the Baptist War in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. And in response to that, and in response to sustained abolitionist pressure, the British abolished slavery in 1834. And that's precisely the moment in U.S. history when South Carolina emerges as really the most aggressive pro-slavery state. Mm-hmm. And the planters there are defending slavery as what John Calhoun called a positive good for, mm-hmm. for human relations.
Yes.
Leading towards secession in the Civil War, which I don't cover in the book, but, mm-hmm. that's certainly foreshadowed.
Okay, and what led you to study this?
Well, I had long wanted to do a comparative study because of... Well, when I was in graduate school, two important books came out in the scholarship on slavery. Ira Berlin's Many Thousands Gone and Philip Morgan's Slave Counterpoint. Mm-hmm. And they're both comparative studies of slavery, but neither one really grasped the politics of slavery in the way I thought was really important, mm-hmm. and I still believe is very important to understanding slave societies.
Okay, let's stop there and talk about that for a minute.
About the politics of slavery?
Right, yes, and why you feel it's so important.
Well, I don't think we can understand the slave societies without seeing the struggle at the heart of it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of literature hasn't really dealt with the significance of slave resistance. I mean, a lot of people, a lot of historians acknowledge slave resistance is there, and we have great studies of slave resistance. But what did it mean? Mm-hmm. How is it significant? And for example, what I do in the book is I show how this dynamic between enslaved people and the masters shaped Jamaica and South Carolina in distinctive ways. Mm-hmm. What I call the domestication of slavery in South Carolina and the militarization of slavery in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. And what that meant was that when the American Revolution, when it's beginning, this imperial crisis that leads the American Revolution, when that begins, the planters in these two slave societies are in very different positions vis-a-vis their slaves, mm-hmm. to be able to confront the British on policies that they saw as oppressive, right? So I argue that it's the way these societies had evolved which allowed South Carolina to join the Patriot Movement and become part of the United States and really inhibits Jamaica, mm-hmm. Inhibits the Jamaican planters from doing that. They are too dependent upon the military apparatus of the British Empire in Jamaica to really establish, to really join with the revolution, even though they shared a lot of the same ideas. Mm-hmm. As patriots in the mainland colonies did.
Okay, so you begin in Barbados, mm-hmm. and a lot of the same men who helped create the slavery situation in Barbados worked in Jamaica as well as South Carolina. But yet you're saying that Jamaica and South Carolina kind of evolved in very different ways. So
right.
let's talk about how different they were. Give us some ideas of what specifically was different.
Okay, so for example, there's sizable Indian populations in South Carolina, what becomes South Carolina, mm-hmm. as the English arrive. And the principal economy for early South Carolina is trade with the indigenous polities in the area. And slaving was really important for that, the capture of indigenous people and selling them as slaves to the northern colonies and also to the Caribbean. And South Carolinians are also enslaving people on their own plantations. But that era of slaving ends in the Yamasee War of 1715 with this violent outburst. It's a very bloody war. And in the aftermath of that war, which almost destroys the colony, if you follow the law, which is one of the things I did, the law actually becomes less harsh. I'm not saying that slavery becomes less harsh, but the assembly clearly wants to curb the most sadistic slaveholders.
And that is fascinating because these are the men who are in South Carolina who are really supporting slavery. So that is kind of a dichotomy between the plantation owners and those people who are making laws. So how do you explain that?
No, the plantation owners are the ones making laws.
Okay, so then why do you think the laws were softened?
Because I think they were concerned about resistance. I think they were concerned about the level of warfare they had seen in the Yamasee War. Mm-hmm. I think they were very worried about. And there had been a lot of rebellions in the Caribbean. And this is an interconnected world, and Carolinians are very aware of the threat of slave rebellion.
Okay.
Right? And then in South Carolina with the Stoner Rebellion of 1739, after that they cut off the slave trade. Right? And they're they pass a new slave code in 1740, which continues that trend of softening that we'd seen in the 1720s and 1730s. But the idea in South Carolina was to make slavery a permanent institution, mm-hmm. within the society, to soften it in order to prolong it,
okay.
right, to make it permanent. In Jamaica, they don't do that. They pass one slave code in 1696. They don't change it until the end of the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and they depend upon military force. There's a permanent garrison of British troops in Jamaica during that whole time, which really, that garrison begins its presence in the island through the First Maroon War, which is this. The Maroons are Africans who escape into the mountains of Jamaica,
mm-hmm.
As early as the English conquest in 1655, and they are able to defend their autonomy from the colony They're Africans, but they're free. And the colony tries, in the 1730s, the colony tries to suppress the Maroons. But they don't. They end up in a draw. They sign treaties. And it's after the, it's in the war and after the treaties that this garrison, this military garrison in Jamaica, becomes a permanent fixture.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Jamaicans are controlling their society through military force in a way that Carolinians are not. And that means that with the imperial crisis and the American Revolution, you have instances of organized slave resistance in both places. Okay? And in Jamaica, when that happens, when there's this big conspiracy in Hanover, in this parish on the north coast, and when that happens, Jamaicans who had been sympathetic to the critiques of empire being offered in the 13 colonies, they just back off. There's no more movements toward supporting what becomes the American Revolution.
And why is that?
They're terrified. They're dependent upon British military force
mm-hmm.
to keep the slaves in check.
Okay.
And that's not the case in South Carolina.
I see.
Right? The whites are able to do it themselves.
Okay. How did you do the research for the book? And were there any surprises along the way that you just didn't foresee?
It's mostly archival. Mm-hmm. I mean, I looked at all the published collections of laws,
mm-hmm.
of course. But the method of the book is to deeply contextualize the passage of these slave codes
mm-hmm.
as they took place. And in the case of Jamaica, documenting this first Maroon War and the rebellions that follow that, and the establishment of the garrison and the way the governors could use the garrison. So it's archival research, principally, mm-hmm. in Jamaica, in South Carolina, and in the UK, in the mm-hmm. British Library, in Kew, in the National Archives. I mean, that's where a lot of the sources are.
Okay. And what were the codes like? What were some of them? The actual laws?
The codes were very, very extensive. And in a way, what's interesting about the codes, and this did surprise me, the codes are not really directed toward enslaved people. They're directed toward whites and the way whites should govern enslaved mm-hmm. people. So if an enslaved person does this, the owner is required to punish in this sort of a way. So it's the assembly's effort to shape the way that white society acts in the governance of its own slaves. And so and that changes over time in response to these moments of organized resistance where the next generation of slaveholders realize, okay, especially in the case of South Carolina, this earlier way of doing things should be changed.
Mm-hmm.
And so they pass a new code. In the Jamaica context, you don't see that they don't adjust their slave code until they come under pressure from the abolitionists,
mm-hmm.
from abolitionists in Great Britain. And it's when they want to save face. It's when the Jamaicans want to portray their slavery as more humane than it was,
mm-hmm.
is when they begin to change their laws to reflect that.
Was there any conversations back and forth between Jamaica and South Carolina in terms of trying to figure out how best to proceed?
Early on, there is. In fact, South Carolina's first slave code, which is passed in 1691, is basically a copy of Jamaica's slave code,
mm-hmm.
Passed a couple of years before. And so they just whole cloth. They just took the slave code. After that, not so much. Okay, there is a lot of commerce
mm-hmm.
back and forth between Jamaica and South Carolina. There are Carolina merchants who are based in Kingston. There are Kingston. You know, there's trade back and forth, but not really about the governance. I expected, based on other comparative studies I had read, I expected and hoped to find more of that,
mm-hmm.
but I really didn't. I looked for it, in the, you know, I looked for it in my research, but I didn't find it.
Right, so no collusion really whatsoever.
Not really.
Interesting.
Except in that early period, there is quite a bit of legal borrowing. Mm-hmm. But after that, the societies really evolve in their own way.
So when slavery was abolished in Jamaica, how did South Carolina react? Did they have any reaction in particular?
Yes. That was the subject of my first book. Because my first book is about the impact of Great Britain's abolition of slavery on the United States and how that shaped the coming of the Civil War, this debate, you know, about the, what's the future of slavery going to be in the United States. And the South Carolina response is, in a way, is really the elaboration of the pro-slavery argument and the development of the idea that slavery, the maintenance of slavery, was fundamental to the constitutional compact, right, that the states had signed and that the states had agreed to, and that Congress had no right to legislate slavery in South Carolina's view, and they stood by that political stance, and that that's not solely as a result of British abolition, but British abolition is certainly one of the events that leads Carolinians to make this argument.
Okay, and who are some of the players, both in Jamaica and in South Carolina?
Some of the players, well, there's slave rebels, like Tacky in Jamaica, like Samuel Sharp later in Jamaica, like Denmark Vesey in South Carolina, and then there's also slaveholders, people like Henry Lawrence in Revolutionary South Carolina, who's really influential. Edward Long, who's a Jamaican historian, slaveholder, and then he writes a long three-volume history of Jamaica. He's very involved in trying to blunt the impact of the abolitionist movement in Great Britain.
And what about the political scene during this time? Who are some of the political players?
Well, I don't. There's not in high politics. You mean? I mean, towards the end of the book, John Calhoun, plays a significant role. Henry Lawrence in high politics earlier on. You know, the Jamaicans are represented by agents. And so one of the individuals I really pay a lot of attention to is a man named Stephen Fuller, who is for a very long time, he's the agent of the Jamaica Assembly in London. So he's basically a lobbyist, and he's lobbying Parliament for Jamaican interests, right? On how the empire is run, and he has his own agenda for the way it should be run, and he's a very influential man. He can get meetings with the prime minister,
right,
and things like that.
So. Well, and then when the abolitionists really started to press hard, what was his response? I mean, I think he probably lost some favor, obviously, with some of the politicians back in London at the time. No.
Sure. The West Indians become unpopular, but it takes a while. It takes a while. And Fuller is actually very involved in orchestrating the West Indian response. And he has meetings. There's a lot of absentees. So these are men who own plantations in the Caribbean, but they live in London and they live in other parts of the UK. And they have the Society of West India Merchants and Planters. And that's a society that dates back to the early 18th century. And they have regular meetings, especially when they're faced with the abolitionist threat, to how are we going to blunt this? How are we going to convince Parliament that the ideas of these activists who they see as radicals are irrelevant and that they should not influence imperial policy?
Right.
And so there's this political struggle within Britain.
So then, once abolition did take place in Jamaica, how were the rules changed, the laws changed at that point? I mean, did they just get stricken from the book? Did they get watered down? What exactly happened?
Well, there's no more slave code,
okay,
which is significant. There's no more.
So it just went away.
It did, but that's not to say that, and this is beyond the book.
The scope of your book,
The scope of the book. But what happens is that the... assemblies come up with different ways to circumscribe the movements and opportunities available to black people. Mm-hmm. And there's a famous book on the early 20th century South by David Ashinsky called Slavery Under Another Name. No, that's the Douglas Blackman book, Slavery Under Another Name, mm-hmm. right? And that's what happens after emancipation, is that the planters, the legislatures, create a different infrastructure, legal and physical, mm-hmm. to maintain the compulsion of people, of those who had been enslaved, to keep on working mm-hmm. For very, very little pay.
Right.
And that happens in both the American South after the Civil War, but in Jamaica beginning in the late 1830s.
Right, right. So it took a while for things to really, truly change.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So what would you like people to take away from your book? What do you conclude?
What do I conclude? One of the big takeaways is that what it is that makes American slavery a more durable institution, okay, than the Caribbean counterpart, at least in the British Empire, is independence, is the achievement of national independence. And that the South Carolinians have a place at the table in the governance of the United States. They're represented in the Congress, in the House and the Senate. They have a say. They can shape governance in a way that their Jamaican counterparts, that their Caribbean counterparts cannot. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that when abolitionism emerges in the United States, which is really influenced by the emergence and success of the British movement,
right,
that slaveholders in the United States are in a far more formidable position to blunt abolitionism, where the Jamaican planters and their West Indian counterparts, they were not in that position. Mm-hmm. They couldn't do anything about public opinion in Britain. Carolinians could, and Carolinians could they had real power. It's
okay.
A big difference.
Well, this has been very interesting. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
For more information about Professor Ruggemer and his research, please visit our website at macmillanreport.yale.edu. Be sure to join us again for another episode of The Macmillan Report, made possible through funding from the Whitney and Betty Macmillan Center for International and Area Studies at Yale.